And so within Sparta, there was already a segment of the population at least willing to consider, under the right circumstances, the renewal of the war. Being Spartans, there would have to be clear violations. Violations of the oath sworn in the spring of 421 BC in the name of the gods, and now erected in stelae in both Sparta and Athens on the peace treaty and the alliance, that Athens had fallen down, as they had done on the 30 years peace back in 432 BC. Well, that was a potentially dangerous situation for the success of this peace. In Athens, and again, as I always mention, the Athenians are different than their Spartan cousins on this, or actually more remote, since the Athenians are Ionian speakers, they're not Dorians. The Athenians, on the other hand, tended to settle their issues by debate and vote in the assembly, and conducted their diplomacy quite openly. And by early 420 BC, Nicias found a new opponent in a man named Alcibiades. In 421 BC, Nicias probably faced no serious challenge in the assembly. Now, there are a number of demagogues running around, guys like Phyax and Hyperbolus, who later gets ostracized. But they were all small fry. None of them could claim the mantle of Cleon. None of them really had an alternate to the policy of peace in 421. In 420 BC, Alcibiades did. There were enough charges of bad faith on the part of the Spartans. The Athenians had handed their prisoners they had taken from the Spartans back in 425 BC. They'd handed them back to the Spartans. The Spartans could not get the Thebans to release the Athenian prisoners. The Thebans were supposed to return the fortress of Panactum, and they did. They totally dismantled the fortress and handed it back to Athens in early 420 BC, just to annoy the Athenians. And that was just another example of bad Spartan faith on it. And the Spartans really found the situation kind of hopeless, and nothing they could do to allay these suspicions, since the Peloponnesians were all acting, or at least the main states in the Peloponnesian League were acting on their own. Alcibiades, at the time, was probably about 30 years of age. He is the son of Cleinias, who is a prominent Athenian politician, a man who fought in the Persian Wars, who proposed an important decree back in 448 BC for the reorganization of the Athenian Empire. All indications are his family were devoted Democrats and would probably be seen more in the radical camp of Democrats. He was probably a second cousin to Pericles, and more important, his father, Cleinias, Alcibiades' father, had fallen at the Battle of Coronae in 447 BC, so that the father of Pericles, Xanthippus, took Alcibiades into his household and raised him as his ward. So Alcibiades essentially was raised in the household of Pericles, and that connection was very powerful. From a young age, Alcibiades saw himself as the political heir of Pericles, the whole Alcmaeonid tradition, that is the noble family that is seen as behind the democratic reforms, going back to the great reformer Cleisthenes. Also, significantly enough, Alcibiades made an important marriage, at least important marriage politically, although as a marriage it was pretty much a failure. He married a woman named Hipparete. Marvelous name. It means the equestrian virtue, a great aristocratic name, who happened to be the daughter of Callias. And therefore, he was linked, Cimon, the great conservative opponent of Pericles, was his uncle. He also saw himself in many ways as the heir to Cimon. And in understanding Alcibiades' antics and acrobatics, diplomatic and military, in the later stages of the Peloponnesian War, you have to realize Alcibiades had these two legacies in mind. He was going to be the greatest orator and political leader since Pericles, and the greatest general since Cimon, and probably in the back of his mind, meaning, gee, if I had lived in the 6th century BC, I could also be the tyrant of Athens, you know, like Pisistratus. So Alcibiades had this great legacy. He was connected to two great aristocratic families. We are told he is an excellent orator. None of his speeches survive except for the renditions given to us by Thucydides, and yet these speeches are indicative of his great oratorical ability. He's classed as the greatest orator in Athens, at least by some, until Demosthenes, who in the age of Alexander the Great and Philip of Macedon is hailed as essentially the greatest orator in the Athenian tradition. He had an endearing lisp and a tendency to stop as he was orating into the assembly to search for the proper words. I always get the feeling he has something of this 18th century English-British conceit with a slight lisp and a little bit slow at times, and then rushes to the punchline. And he spoke in very powerful and yet understandable words. which I also suspect contrasted with the gesticulation, the harsh words used by the demagogues, which Thucydides and conservative Athenians saw as almost gutter language, and the very ornate language and sophisticated language used by the political conservatives and oligarchs. Alcibiades knew his audience. He knew exactly how to put the words together and persuade the Athenian assembly. He also was an absolutely outrageous figure. Just to give you a couple of indications of that, by the time he emerges on the political scene, he had entered 7 chariot teams at Olympia and won 1st, 2nd, and 4th place,